Bucks Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you on this Wednesday. We made it through halfway through another week. Miracles never cease here. Behold, the power of faith to keep on going here. Coming up on the program today, Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall. He joins us at the bottom of the hour. We also got the Mayor Sims, David Baker, coming in studio. Another in-studio guest coming up right after that. Jerry Carl, the Republican nominee for Alabama's 1st Congressional District, and what we are going to make our usual Wednesday guest from Yellowhammer News, my good friend Sean Ross. He's the editor-in-chief of Yellowhammer News. So, go check that out. That's a good source of local information. Some things to talk about here. The big story, Kamala Harris named Joe Biden's running mate yesterday. Not a terribly big surprise. It looked to me, in the very, very late going of this, there were some kind of stories that Susan Rice was still in the mix. I thought that would have been kind of it seemed like maybe a little bit of a long shot, but it gained steam, throughout the day. We already knew it wasn't going to be Karen Bass or Stacey Abrams or any of these other candidates that were under the running. But Kamala Harris is the safe pick. She's in the Senate, so she's won an election. She's won an election on a grand scale in the state of California. It is the safe pick. It feels to me like this, though. I think they still want to make this the referendum on President Trump. They know that people are going to... They think in their mind, and it's such a bubble mentality almost, that people are going to just go vote up or down on the president, and they're not really offering the alternative. They're not playing up the alternative. So what we voted for Donald Trump the first time, there was people going out to vote for Trump, not against Hillary. There may have been some of that, but I think the prevailing motivation there was obviously, hey, Trump's the guy that's going to, he is going to go and shake up Washington and drain the swamp or whatever. On the other hand, I also think, you look at Obama, you wanted to vote for the first African-American president, certainly a historic moment, right? Well, what are you voting for here? You're voting for Joe Biden. This just kind of seems like a guy that's, it was just his turn in line. He's ran a couple of times before. He was the vice president. It's his turn. Kamala Harris, well, you gotta bring on somebody to get the African American vote or the female vote. Perhaps you bring in the suburban moms. That's always been a problematic area for President Trump. That's the play there. But it just seems this is prevent defense. That we know we're going to win. It's a referendum on Trump, and Trump's not doing that well right now. So let's go with the safe play, because Kamala Harris is the safe play. She's not a Hail Mary. She's not something crazy. Susan Rice would have been that one reminded me of sort of like Dick Cheney. When George Bush named Dick Cheney, because this is a guy who never really held elective office except for a congressional seat in Wyoming, but was always kind of the bureaucrat, a cabinet head, and worked his way in to be vice president. The guy that knows the belly of the beast, how everything works. And Susan Rice certainly would have been that person. Kamala Harris is more of it fits what they were looking for. And that tells me this, though. It does. They think they're in good shape. They think they have a lead. And the polls indicate as much. Double digits in some cases in national polls. They think they have a lead. Don't do anything crazy. Don't do anything out of ordinary. Stay within the bounds, and you're the next president of the United States, Joe Biden. People try to read into this too much, but I'm not so certain that's really, really what's going on. There's some kind of 3D chess being played. No, they don't want to they don't want to mess up anything. Some Paul text, do you think they were waiting for Michelle Obama to say no for the 100th time? Michelle Obama would have been a very historic pick, a curious pick. And would that have driven people out? You know, a Michelle Obama pick would have been, hey, we're down by 15 points to Donald Trump. We need something special here. We need some excitement. Michelle Obama seems to be pretty popular within the Democratic Party. That's going to get people out. It would have been not quite like, but a little bit like a Sarah Palin nomination. So they'll watch the polls. I think the next few days, tracking polls will show a little bit of a bump coming out of this. But I have not been impressed with the rollout. Now, COVID's really hampered a lot of the normal things you see for a vice presidential rollout. But what are the big events we have scheduled? Look at this, guys. Kamala Harris, she runs for president, doesn't do that well. She just seems like she was the obvious choice to be a running mate. She was playing for the Veep stakes all along. She needed to get to national exposure, get up there on the debate stage. Early on, she may have thought she had a shot at winning the nomination, getting in these dust-ups with Joe Biden very early on. Going to have to account for that at some point. But then as time went on, that path narrowed for Kamala Harris to be the Democratic nominee, and it seemed as if she was playing for the running mate role. And that's fine. That's kind of the way it's done. If you ask this, though, we know the history there. We know about the contentious nature of presidential primaries and Kamala Harris and Joe Biden really having gotten into it a few times, had a few dust-ups along the way there. History will tell you this. There's dust-ups in all of these. And then if one of these guys so happens to be a running mate later on, they make up. They're best friends. What I always think of, Reagan and George W. Bush in 1980, they came together two terms. Some of the others, one that sticks out of my mind, John Kerry and John Edwards in the 2004 cycle, that got pretty ugly. And then John Edwards goes on to be John Kerry's running mate. That doesn't end as well. But it happens. It happens where you just pick the guy that seems to do better in different parts of the country, and your person does better, and then they make up, and they're best friends, and, you know, it's no hard feelings, right? I don't think you're going to be able to make a whole lot out of that. Republicans will try, but most educated people understand that you do these things because you want to win an election. So we'll see how that plays out. It seems to be going well so far. There's all these theories that Biden, he can't possibly, they're not expecting him to even serve out his full term. We're going to have President Harris. I mean, that's getting a little ahead of ourselves. I think Biden wants to be president of the United States. I think he's motivated to be. He's run before. And Biden in the public eye and Biden behind the scenes are two different people. And Biden's got to listen to his advisors. Not that they're listening to right-wing talk show host Jeff Poor here for pointers, but it's clear to me you can look at Biden and you see a guy that's not listened to the people around him. He has a kind of a mentality that's like, hey, I've done this before. You're not going to give me pointers. You're not going to tell me how to run my campaign. You're not going to tell me how to... But he needs to listen. There's very smart people that he has surrounded himself with. So it seems to me it would stand to reason he should listen to those guys. If they can start, you know, playing maybe a little more strategically. Don't go off on the Yahoo News reporter about being a junkie. Stick to the script, man. Be disciplined. If you really think that you got this sewn up and this campaign is playing it safe, then stick to the script. I think it's going to present problems later on in the election. I don't think you could be as buttoned up and have success in politics, particularly American politics, at that level. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. They have pollsters. They talk to their guys. They know, they think they know where the election is going, which way the wind is blowing. Then Biden, that's the whole problem with the Biden campaign. And if he loses, this will be the Monday morning quarterback situation here. I just think he just didn't listen to his folks here tell him how to act and how to comport himself on the campaign trail. And if they had a game plan. They had the data. They had the people. They had the surrogates. But he just doesn't seem to be disciplined enough to stick to the script. And you see this in politics all the time. Sometimes it works for people. It doesn't work for Biden. Now, Trump's the same way. Somehow it works for Trump because people see Trump say something and they think, oh, well, it's two different electorates. So let's face it. Democrats want somebody that follows the rules. Democrats like that. They like the idea of, you know, some higher power or some force out there that kind of steers things in the right direction. Republican Party right now, it's people that are dissatisfied with what's going on in Washington. And I say this, I use this over and over again, they want to send people to Washington, D.C., their square pegs to go fit in round holes that cause disruption. And maybe that is a strong enough force that will steer things in the right direction. This pick with Kamala Harris yesterday, that's not that kind of pick. This is an establishment pick. Wall Street is thrilled about this. Silicon Valley is thrilled about this pick. The big business powers are very happy. K Street is happy about this pick. It's somebody they can play ball with. It's somebody that understands you've got to be one thing for the public. You've got to play that pro wrestling role. And then behind the scenes, all right, let's get down to business. Let's start talking about what we're going to do here. Policy-wise, let's understand that this is... I know I got to do one thing on the campaign trail, and then when I'm elected, I got to do another thing. And Republicans will point this out over and over again. You can look at Kamala Harris's record as Attorney General, and you could say, well, she says one thing, but she's tough on crime over here. Well, you know, what's that contradiction all about? There's going to be those contradictions that arise, but that just tells you the character of this ticket, I think, that they will tell you one thing to get elected, and they'll do another thing, and that's you kind of get to please everybody, because are people really paying that close attention to all of this? And I would argue they aren't when it comes to the very nuances of policy. And really, it's not. And it's not this as much as we like to think that there's this big ideological battle going on, and people go down to the well of the House of Representatives, and they have these deep philosophical discussions about, you know, what's good for, what's constitutional, or what's limited government, or what's good for the masses, or but no, it's not. It's sometimes they give those speeches, but that's not really how things are decided. It's in a room somewhere with the committee chairman, and they write the bills, and they talk about the policy, and they write the regulations. It's all run behind the scenes, and they feed the public sort of a diet of candy of what they want to hear to get elected. Kamala Harris plays that very well. She's not thinking. She's not a one-trick pony either. She has other issues. She's got a portfolio of things that are her issues. And you look at some of these other candidates that were in the running for that spot, they didn't have this diverse portfolio of issues. So some of them were one issue people. It's always the problem with Democratic Party is you have a bunch of different, you have all these coalitions, or you have a coalition of all these different interests built into one to defeat Donald Trump. We gotta take a time out. We'll return. This is FM Talk 106.5. There's always a beautiful babe to squeeze my life in my simple way. Guess you could say I'm living in the big time. Welcome back to Jeff Moore Show at FM Talk 106.5. Coming up in the next segment, we'll hear from I'm Attorney General Steve Marshall, so make sure you stay tuned for that. Some other things going on. We talked about college football earlier on Mobile Mornings. Dalton and I a lot of politicians hopping on the bandwagon to want to see the season played. And I think there's a lot of politics involved because people, when they find out they're not going to have football, well, what's that reaction going to be like, particularly in the state of Alabama? Because people were upset in the Big Ten. I think this is going to be a big test as to whether or not, just to gauge public reaction here, what's stuff people really, really care about? And we've always assumed it's college football. I mean, we're all big Auburn, Alabama fans. Yeah, it may not be quite the, it may not quite be the craze that it's portrayed to be in a lot of circles, particularly outside of Alabama, as if it really is a religion. For some people, it is. I think it's mixed. Most adults realize it is a spectator sport with young adults. But it probably gets down to the reasoning. Like, what is the science here? What is the reason for doing this? What is the threat? What is, you know, for all of these policy gestures aimed at mitigating the threat of COVID-19, is there a cost-benefit analysis? Is there a risk assessment being done? And when they are done, are you explaining to us what this is going to do to accomplish to make things better or keep things from getting worse? That's what's important in all of this. And understanding that that seems to be lacking in a lot of this. And when we find out that you're going to cancel the football season, or you're going to postpone it till the spring, then explain to people why. And if that's not satisfactory, that may feel, I don't know, some kind of political reaction. I mean, everything is political right now. We are in election season, guys. And if you find out that there's no football season, would you run on that? Would you run on that as a hey, these guys will take away your college football? Maybe. There's a lot of people that think Robert Bentley got elected because of that. Because how Tim James talked about Auburn and Alabama on Paul Feinbaum's show. I don't know that to be the case. I think that might be an exaggeration. But people are really going to get tired of all these measures and being told it's for your own personal good, but you don't know for a fact, or they're not explaining it to you sufficiently. But the governor, I think the big tell is Governor Ivey. She says let them play. Members of Congress in the state are saying let them play. Tommy Tupper, well, what is Doug Jones going to say? That's a very interesting question for me. We may try to get him on sometime this week or next week. Find out what he thinks about this. And now I'm going to say we will be fine if there's no college football season. It'll just be like everything else. Life will go on. But it is amazing how that 1916 pandemic, the Spanish flu, they managed to play football. The teachers union backed Bentley in the runoff against Bradley Byrne. I am totally referring to the Republican primary, gubernatorial primary 2010. How did Robert Bentley ease his way into that runoff spot? That's wasn't the teachers union. That apparently, if you read Feinbaum's book, he talks about how he had Bentley on his show. And they talked about, you know, the Tuscaloosa tie there, Bentley being from Tuscaloosa, the University of Alabama. So there was a lead up to the whole AEA fiasco or whatever you want to consider happened there in that 2010 gubernatorial election. But for the first time, we're going to see the politics of college sports. We've already gotten a taste of it with the candidacy of Tommy Tupperville. Guess what? Tupperville won in Tuscaloosa County over Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions, who was for 20 years a United States Senator, everybody knew him. And Tommy Tupperville, a guy that ran around Bryant Denny Stadium with his fingers up in the air, counting the number of wins against Alabama consecutively. Tommy Tupperville still won that county. So how much do the college football politics and the two intermingle, and what does that really mean? But I think if people get upset because they cancel the season, it won't be because the season's canceled. It'll be because of all these extraordinary measures we're taking without much explanation, without much justification. Just a shrug. We have to listen to the CDC. So well, that remains to be seen. There will be an outcry if it happens. Mark my words. We have taken our time out. We will return. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.
In Dixieland delight, we tell stories about what goes on in Montgomery at midnight. Cause Music Row ain't only in Tennessee. So won't you bury me in Dixie?
FM Talk 106.5, the Gulf Coast Weather Authority, and Dr. Bill Williams.
The skies will be partly cloudy across the Gulf Coast today. Look for scattered thunderstorms with temperatures in the lower 90s this afternoon. Tonight, isolated evening thunderstorms, lows in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, mostly sunny with scattered afternoon thunderstorms and high temperatures in the lower 90s. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Williams for FM Talk 106.5.
FM Talk 106.5, the Gulf Coast Weather Authority.
Get out of that long boat ramp line and head to Yellowhammer Fishing, Mobile's only local kayak and paddleboard dealer. Kayaks and fishing accessories for our local waterways. Open now in Theodore, next to Hood's, or see all the brands at Yellowhammer Fishing on Facebook.
Time now for your plain gardening tip with Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5. Bill can be heard every Sunday morning from 9 to 11 with Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Bill talks about gardening and life in our unique corner of the world. Here's today's tip with Bill Finch.
Do your potted plants look like they're dying of drought in spite of all this rain? Wait, don't water them again. It's very possible that your plant is dying because it's getting too much water. It is, in short, drowning. And the symptoms of drowning can be virtually identical to the symptoms of drought. During periods of heavy rainfall, conventional potting soils can get so wet there's no oxygen left in the soil. And without oxygen, the plant roots die. Use a fast-draining soil mix and be prepared to change container soil frequently.
Your business deserves better. Better internet, better phones, and better support. At C Spire Business, better is what we do best. With our business internet and phone bundles, you won't just get higher speeds, more reliability, and industry-leading VoIP phones. You'll get local experts who are there for you 24/7. So your business doesn't just run better, it is better. Find the best internet and phone bundle for your business at cspire.com/businessbundle.
Buying a pre-owned car doesn't mean buying old, but it does mean saving thousands. Browse our pre-owned inventory at 90westauto.com. Then see the cars on our spacious lot right next to Mobile Lumber on Highway 90. If you're searching for a nice pre-owned vehicle or boat, that's all you'll find at 90 West. And in-house financing gives you more options than traditional lenders. Even when your credit is good but your debt ratio is challenging, 90 West Auto and Marine will make it work. Drive west for your next new-to-you vehicle or boat at 90 West Auto and Marine, or see us on Facebook.
Though the world may change, the mission of Southern Cancer Center will not. Our patients come first, as they always have. It's just our culture. As the area's only community-based oncology practice, our physicians specialize in one thing, cancer. Through early detection, prevention, and survivorship, we provide comprehensive care by delivering cutting-edge therapies, personalized treatment plans, and the respect every patient deserves. See what makes Southern Cancer Center different. Visit us online at southerncancercenter.com.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5, 34 minutes after the hour on this Wednesday afternoon. So to come on the program today, Dave Baker, the mayor of Sims, will also have Republican nominee for the 1st Congressional District, Jerry Carl, and from Yellhammer News, Sean Ross. So please stay tuned for that. But join us now, a good friend of my old program up in Huntsville. Always good to get him on when possible. The Attorney General of Alabama, Steve Marshall, joins us. General Marshall, how are you today?
I'm doing well, by the way. Congrats on the new show and being able to give Mobile all kind of great knowledge going forward. So excited for you and excited for Mobile and the station.
Thank you, thank you. You're way too kind. Let's get into this though. I guess the first question I like to ask in this, you know, it's COVID-19. Why really handling the duties of your office, the challenges with the coronavirus out there? Has that really changed your day-to-day operations that much?
Jeff, it's been unprecedented in some ways. And if you kind of go back, you know, I'm actually giving a presentation later today about COVID-19 liability protections across the country. And sort of looking back, I mean, we're 6 months into a wholesale change on kind of how this country is operated and what we do day to day. And so if you look at how very quickly all this has changed, even in Alabama, you know, kind of the initial question for us came up when Governor Ivey was asked about whether or not she was going to move the date of the initial primary in the Republican Party. And, you know, when that runoff got moved, and the question was whether or not she had certain authority under the Emergency Management Act. And then from that has flowed all of the issues that have arisen from state health orders from Dr. Harris to kind of this essential versus non-essential business question. It's now migrated into a different way, and it's posed all kind of new and frankly very interesting legal questions for us, as well as litigation on the abortion side and the voting area. And frankly, we are as busy as we've ever been here, but with handling cases that are as interesting and insightful as anything that I've ever seen.
I mean, it's a situation where a lot of these agencies and a lot of different things rely on the Attorney General for guidance on whatever the issue might be pertaining to this breakout.
No, absolutely. And, you know, and even from just kind of simple interpretations of whether or not the law or the regulations that have been adopted, you know, apply in this setting. And so, you know, we created a team here in five different areas that had points of contact, whether it was on the consumer side or the business side, to try to be able to help answer questions. And I think we've talked about it before. I really do see the Attorney General is somebody that tries to call balls and strikes, and that my job is not to get engaged in discussions about what Alabama policy ought to be, or if I were in a different position, what I would do, but in fact to be able to defend the lawful actions of whether it be the governor or the state health officer or other aspects of government, defending what John Merrill is doing in certain areas. Again, a unique opportunity. I'm very blessed to be able to be in this role, and I think the last 6 months have probably been the most challenging of my 30-plus years as a lawyer.
Do you think at some point, I mean, obviously, with all of this gray area out there and all these unknowns, it would probably be on the Alabama legislature to take this on and maybe add some clarity?
Oh, I think clearly, you know, in fact, I've had several discussions with individuals as we've gone along about, as we've sort of been confronted with a pandemic, which is something obviously unprecedented in all of our lifetimes, you know, what are those gaps or what are those holes or what are those concerns going forward? I'll give you just an example. When Birmingham initially adopted some local ordinances, they did it under the authority of a quarantine, but yet we had no definition of what a quarantine was under Alabama law. And so part of what we were having to do when we evaluate certain questions is really see if we have guidance from the code of Alabama or the Constitution. And when you don't see that, it makes it more difficult to be able to answer those bright line tests. And so I think there are several areas that will be looked at going forward. I know I've had, again, multiple discussions with individuals about it. And I think it's given us an opportunity to help improve and clarify the existing laws of the state as we move forward and hopefully never deal with a situation like this again, at least in our lifetimes.
Oh, and then the added component here, dealing with just that on the ground law enforcement, those issues there with policing and things like that. That you know, how involved have you been in that aspect? Because you have these whole new set of circumstances, a whole new environment, maintaining law and order in this age of coronavirus on the ground. How much has that really changed, and what's your role in that?
Well, I think twofold is what we've seen. And let's, we talk about coronavirus, but let's also talk about kind of the narrative and discussion going on across the country about law enforcement. I mean, both of those have kind of come together at the same point in time and presented their own unique challenges. But at least as to law enforcement, you know, very early on, we were giving guidance to them directly about the fact that just because a state health order may be deemed a misdemeanor or a violation of the governor's executive order could be enforced criminally, that we wanted to make sure that individuals were using discretion in the right way, that we were doing our job to be able to inform the public of the requirements of the law and give people an opportunity to be able to comply. And I think, you know, for example, you take the mask ordinance. I'm not aware of any citation or any prosecution that's been initiated as a result of the governor's actions of a month or so ago when we implemented her statewide mask ordinance. And we saw very few actions relating to any other aspects of Dr. Harris's order. And I think that is reflective of law enforcement acting in a very responsible way and being able to help, again, not only educate individuals about what the responsibilities were under these new provisions, but also ways to be able to remedy it if there was a problem. And so only where there were really direct public health concerns that needed to be mitigated quickly did we see really much of a response. So I'm very proud. In fact, I've been talking to chiefs and sheriffs through Zoom across the state over the last couple of weeks, and I think one of the things that I have presented as a message is to make sure and tell them how much I appreciate how they've acted. And then beyond that, you know, knowing what's going on sort of since George Floyd, and you know, we've been very vocal in being able to say that we completely reject this idea that there is systemic abuse and racism within law enforcement as a whole, that despite the fact that there was, I think, universal condemnation for the actions of George Floyd by law enforcement in Alabama, it doesn't mean necessarily that that's the way that we do our business here. And so, you know, we've continued to be able to say that this defund the police movement is short-sighted, and we simply can look, you know, for example, in Portland, where, you know, they defund the violent crime unit, and then the next month they have the highest number of homicides they've had in their recent history. And I don't think those two are separable from one another. In fact, I think they go hand in hand. And so when we talk about the role of law enforcement, not only in our country and our state, you know, I've been very proactive and very vocal to be able to say that these are remarkably professional men and women who come to work every day to be able to protect us, and we need to support them.
And then that maintains, like, maintaining that morale among law enforcement. You had a rough 2019 with all the police shootings, but then you have the sort of the mood of the public. Well, maybe not here in Alabama, but maybe in other places. And it's imagine trying to. It's difficult for me to imagine trying to operate as a law enforcement officer, police department, or sheriff's department with that in the backdrop, in the back of my mind.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you heard discussion many years ago about the Ferguson effect and whether or not, as a result of what happened in Ferguson, in which the law enforcement officer there was vindicated not only once, but apparently now twice with a recent investigation or reopening the investigation by a new prosecutor there, is that law enforcement kind of sat back in many ways and because of concerns about whether or not they would be criticized for doing their job. And, you know, what I've told the men and women that I come into contact here with is, number one, thank you for what they do, but go out and do the job that they're tasked with doing, which is not always easy. They clearly don't always get those attaboys. But one of the things that I've been really, really encouraged by as I've had these discussions with police and sheriffs is how much they've told me about the public support of them during this period of time, whether it be in public gatherings and in times where the individuals and communities have come out to vocally support law enforcement, as well as instances in which they talk about food being delivered and other individuals coming up and doing things for law enforcement officers especially. And you know, you're right, Jeff, it was a very, very difficult and has been, you know, almost 18 months for us in law enforcement in Alabama as we've lost record numbers across the state from Mobile all the way to Huntsville. And those are men and women and sons and daughters that have lost their lives simply trying to be able to keep us safe. And I think we always have to be mindful of that.
We're joined by Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall here on the program. I want to move on to the Department of Justice, obviously, putting out a reporter memo a few weeks ago about the prison situation in Alabama. You've spoken out about the possibility of a consent decree. You've spoken out against it. Have you, since that moment, have you interacted with the DOJ? Are there any discussions going on? Really, where do you think we are with regards to the prison situation?
you know, it's our intentions to continue acting in good faith and allow those negotiations to move forward. You know, we have been doing that for quite some time, and in fact, in the negotiations, representatives of the Department of Justice have acknowledged that. We're meeting again with them this week, and it is our hope that we can come to a appropriate understanding and consensus about where it is that we move forward. And, you know, Jeff, part of my frustration, frankly, has been that not long after I got here, I sat down with representatives of the Department of Justice to say, you know, we acknowledge that there are areas that, that we need to improve in our system, whether it be facilities, whether it be staffing, whether it be the delivery of certain services inside our prisons. And we can reach a very quick understanding of what those need to be, but let's move forward in trying to work collaboratively like we did with Tutwiler, which is now deemed a model prison according to the Department of Justice across the country. Let's work together to be able to resolve it in the other facilities that we have dealing with men in the state. And yet, you know, they chose to say, no, let's spend another year and a half and we'll work on issuing these reports and then we'll get to the business of doing that. And so that's why I do appreciate the fact that Governor Ivey and working with Commissioner Dunn have been developing a strategic plan that they've implemented relating to hiring and relating to facilities, and we've made much progress. And I do think that that report that came out is partly a historical perspective of where we were several years ago and is not necessarily reflective of where we are now. And so a consent decree is an extreme remedy. In fact, Attorney General Sessions, one of the last things he did was to sign a memo that says that those are to be used in very limited circumstances, because what we've seen is that they are not an effective way to be able to change in an appropriate way government institutions. And so we're going to continue to work moving forward. We want to be able to make positive changes, but at the same time, you know, I was telling somebody a little bit about an analogy that if two people in a car wreck and somebody hits them from behind going 5 miles an hour, you're going to be able to pay if their bumper's damaged. But if the driver says, you know, you owe me $100,000 for mental anguish, well, you're probably going to push back on that. And so we can acknowledge the fact that we need to make changes. It doesn't necessarily mean that if we say that we have to litigate it, it's because that we're not willing to be able to do the right thing. So our team has been instructed to continue to negotiate and continue to work, and that's exactly what we'll do.
I mean, it seems to me from reading the report, my initial reaction was, how is this going on right now when we know the DOJ is really scrutinizing what's going on in the Alabama Department of Corrections? But you take a closer look at it, and these incidents they're talking about, they're long, they're, you know, 2018 or earlier. Was this to be like some kind of flashbang or something like that to kind of get some of the powers that be in the state to get moving on this? And does that complicate your role in the prison question?
Great question, Jeff, and I wish I could answer exactly. Because if you look back in April of 2018, the initial report was released identifying two different areas of the investigation, and they withheld two others to do it at a later time. And so why they chose to do that, and let's also recognize that report also found that Alabama was not having significant problem with sexual assault and violence with inside the prisons, and so obviously that's encouraging. But yeah, I think you speak to exactly the frustration I described earlier, is that this was a report, again, nothing that we don't need to stand up and make sure that we correct, but of older news that was already in the public domain. And so why it is that the Department of Justice chose to do that at this point, I can't particularly tell you, although I will say just simply as a matter of federal law, the issuance of that report becomes a trigger for them after a certain period of time to be able to initiate litigation. And so that singularly could be the basis for it. But my hope is that both sides recognize that litigation is not in the best interest of either party. But the problem with that consent decree, I think, as you well know, is that I turn over control by signing it to third parties that are not connected to Alabama, that have direct ability to impact the general fund and the amount of money that goes to the prisons in the general fund, and for which there is zero accountability to the people of Alabama and the decisions they make. And I'm just simply not going to do that.
And 2 weeks ago, we'll wrap it up on the prison question on this. Could it have been that they were going to go after these prison guards on these charges? The Department of Justice, they had to get this report out there before they went to a grand jury to seek indictments. I mean, was that maybe part of the calculus?
You know, again, that would be for them to discuss. I don't see why it would be. But let's also recognize that, we in Alabama have gone after some of those same guards and that they have been investigated and charged. And again, we're going to do our job to hold them accountable when they violate the law.
Last question here pertains to the census, your census lawsuit with Congressman Mo Brooks. You had some good news a few weeks ago with Trump's executive order. Just for the listeners here, give us kind of a rundown of where that stands right now.
This is litigation that goes back to early in my time here, where we just simply said that for purposes of the census, and one of the reasons for the census is to be able to get the apportionment counter, to figure out how many House representatives you will have from certain states based on population, that we said constitutionally the president should not include those who are in this country unlawfully, because we have not only experts that tell us that if you count those who are here illegally, that Alabama would lose a congressional seat despite the participation rate that we have in the census, and the argument in that case is that they shouldn't be counted. In President Trump's memorandum, it actually wasn't an executive order, it was simply a memorandum to the Department of Commerce to do exactly what we had discussed and have advocated in that case, and that is to be able to give him a number for purposes of apportionment that would remove those who are in this country unlawfully, because the incentive for other states, and California is clearly one of them, is to embrace sanctuary cities and to disavow the enforcement of immigration laws, because it's going to be in their best interest to do so. In the last three different cycles of the census, they have increased their representation in Congress, which also, by the way, means that they've increased the number of votes they have in the Electoral College. And part of the reason they've done that is because they've become a sanctuary for those who are in this country unlawfully. And again, we don't believe that individuals that are here without legal status that otherwise aren't allowed to vote ought to be able to dilute the representation of members of Congress for us here in Alabama. And so Judge Proctor has asked for the parties to be able to brief the question of what is the impact of the president's order. We don't believe that it is caused our case to be mooted or to no longer go forward. We've asked him to continue to proceed, but also it won't surprise you that New York has challenged what the president's done in a separate action now. California has challenged what the president's done in a separate action, and we have five other different cases as well going around the country. And so this will be a litigated issue moving forward. We are prepared to try our case in front of Judge Proctor, and we've been working very hard to get that case ready, and I appreciate that Congressman Brooks has been standing with us on that one as well, because it's an important question for Alabama.
Sure, Marshall, we got to leave it there. We're out of time. We got to get to commercial, but I want to thank you for making time for us this morning.
No, thank you for having me. We'll do it again.
Absolutely. We'll do it again real soon. That was Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall. We got to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Ooh, Montgomery.